But we actually left off with about verse 26 of the 11th chapter in our exposition. So I want to pick up with verse 26 and maybe give you a little chart to help you with the patriarchal family tree, the family tree of Abraham, his brothers, and so on. There's still intermarriage going on quite a bit within the family, direct intermarriage. And so it gets a little confusing. So let's begin with verse 26 of chapter 11. And Terah lived 70 years, and he begat Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. The order in which he begat these children. We do know that Abraham, of course, becomes the focal point of the rest of Abraham and his seed of the rest of the Old Testament. If you want to write a good date down, write 2166 under the name Abraham, and you'll have his birth date. And on the table in the lobby when you leave, you might get a sheet entitled Establishing Old Testament Chronology. When did Abraham live? And we try to establish on there somewhat of an absolute date for the birth of Abraham. Now we have another one of our sections in Genesis introduced in verse 27. Now these are the generations of Terah. This is the literary schemata of this book. It's broken down into this statement. These are the generations of Terah. Terah begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran begat Lot. And Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity in Ur of the Chaldees. So down in the Mesopotamia Valley, down near Babylon, or what we would know as Babylonia, Abraham was born and raised, and his one brother died before he left there. Now when they leave there, they'll go up the Fertile Crescent, up the Mesopotamia Valley, to a town named Haran, we'll find. It has the same name as this brother. How that came to be, we're not told. Haran died in Ur. Verse 29, and Abraham and Nahor took them wives. And the name of Abraham's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran. In other words, Nahor marries his niece, the father of Milcah, the father of Iscah. But Sarah was barren, she had no child. She will have her first child when she is what? 90 years old. And Terah took Abraham, well, let's stop right there, okay? And let's work a little bit on the patriarchal family tree. The patriarchal family tree. I want to try to get this all in one shot up here, and I haven't tried it, so I want to raise that up there as high as I can and get this all on so you can see the whole thing at once. Now we start with Terah. He is in the lineage of which of the sons of Noah? Shem, Ham, or Japheth? Shem. Okay? So, what the Old Testament is saying is blessing will come. The promised seed will come, and you begin with the sons of Adam and Eve. And it will not come through Cain. It will not come through Abel. It will come through Seth. Okay? Then Seth has, the Sethite line begins to run its course. And in the Sethite line, it will come through whom? Number 10. Or one of the three of number 10. No, number 10. Noah. Then Noah has three sons. It will not come through Ham or Japheth. It will come through Shem. Then you have the Shemite lineage. And you get down to Terah, and then he has three sons. And it will not come through Nahor or Haran. It will come through Abraham. But I want to give the whole tree, so we'll put the three sons of Terah down up here. Haran, Nahor, and Abraham. Haran, Nahor, and Abraham. Now Haran, as you piece this little thing together, you find that he has three children. Issachar, whom we hear no more of, and Milcah, who is a gal, and we hear more of her because she marries her uncle Nahor and bears him eight children, probably the most important of which, well, is Bethuel, because through Bethuel is going to come Laban and Rebekah. Rebekah will then marry Isaac. Laban will bear two daughters, Leah and Rachel, and they will both marry Jacob, see? So this picture is one of interfamily marriages, and it gets confusing unless you can get some overview of it. The third child of Haran was Lot. Okay? Okay, now we said that Nahor bears Bethuel. And Bethuel is the son of Nahor by Milcah. By Milcah. Okay? Okay. Now Abraham is going to bear two important sons, actually more than that. But one will be Ishmael. Ishmael of Hagar. And of course the important one, the promised seed, Isaac of Sarai. And that of course is the exciting part of the story of Abraham, one of the exciting parts, the birth of Isaac, the miracle birth of Isaac. Okay? Now let's proceed down one more step in the patriarchal family tree that is going to spring out of the sons of Terah. Lot will become the progenitor of Moab, from whom comes the Moabites, and Ammon, from whom comes the Ammonites. And these become the enemies of Israel when Israel is ready to go into the promised land. Bethuel, who was the son of Nahor by Milcah, will beget two important personages in the Old Testament story and development of the patriarchal family tree, Laban and Rebekah. Okay? Laban, well, let's keep going across the line, okay? Isaac is the son of Sarah, and he will team up with Rebekah, and of Rebekah will be two important sons, Esau and Jacob, twins. And we need to run this line down a little bit to try to get Rebekah in here, okay? Esau and Jacob. These are both of Rebekah. Okay. Now Laban, as you know, has two daughters. And remember, Rebekah was a good wife and a faithful wife to Isaac, but she wanted to help God out. And so she plotted a way in which she could get both the blessing for her son Jacob and also get him away from trouble. And she plotted a maneuver whereby he would go to Uncle Laban and visit for a while and maybe get a wife. Instead, he comes back with actually two and two concubines, Leah and Rachel, the daughters of Laban. Okay? Okay, so under Jacob now, proceeding out of Jacob, we have a big line that comes across, because really now we're going to have the 12 children, or the 12 patriarchs of Israel out of Jacob. Okay? So first of all, we draw a line all the way across out of Jacob, and we have to say of Leah, he will bear Reuben. I got a new pair of glasses and I'm having trouble seeing. And I'm going to number these in the way that they were born in terms of the chronology. Okay? Number one was Reuben. Remember, Uncle Laban was just as schemy and as crooked as was Jacob. And so Jacob thought he was working 7 years for Rachel, and he got Leah. Then he had to work 7 more years. During that time, some children were born. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and 4, Issachar. Okay. Now he's going to have more children to Leah, but he's going to get some wives and concubines in between and have some children by them. So the numbers changed. I'm sorry, did I put 4 for Issachar? I don't know if these glasses are going to work. Issachar is number 9. 4 is Judah. 4 is Judah. Okay? Okay. 9 is Issachar, the 9th child. And 10 is Zebulun. All of these are from Leah. And I guess we have to put Dinah in there, but she didn't count because she was a female. Females didn't count until Jesus Christ came. Okay? Okay. One of the concubines that he has is named Zilpah. Okay? Zilpah bears him 2 sons, and they are in this patriarchal family tree. The first, which is really the 7th child, is Gad. The second of Zilpah, which is really the 8th child, is Asher. Okay? The other concubine that he took's name was Bilhah. B-I-L-H-A-H. Bilhah bare him 2 children, and they are number six, Dan, and number 7, can you see that? Is that a little too small? Let me run it up here, maybe that will help. Dan and Naphtali, and Naphtali is number 6, as we said. Sorry, did I make this one 6? That should be 5. Okay. Finally, he gets Rachel for wife, the woman that he wanted all the time. And Rachel bears him 2 sons. And I'm going to have to move them down a little because I'm running out of space. They are numbers 11 and 12 of these great patriarchal of this great patriarchal family, Joseph and Benjamin. Okay. Now, out of whom is going to come Messiah? Where is the seed going to come? Judah. So we can, for purposes of communication, so that this adds some meaning to you, Messiah will come out of Judah. On what basis? Why did Messiah come out of Judah? Why did Messiah come out of Judah and not out of Issachar? Pardon? Can't hear. Are you looking for the switch to turn it off? No. Why? Yeah, because God chose them. That's right. Yeah, sovereign choice of God. Yeah. We don't know why. He doesn't tell us. Now, do we have the whole thing on that shot? Okay, there you are. That is the patriarchal family tree that springs out of Terah. Now, the rest of Genesis concerns itself with this development. See, particularly the right-hand line over here. These other names only come in as they relate to Abraham and his direct descendants. See? And the rest of Genesis, or the rest of the Old Testament, is going to concern itself with the history of the nation that comes out of Abraham. And that's why it is so important to get clued in sharply on Abraham, who he was, what happened, what the promise was, and so on. Moreover, Abraham is mentioned more times in the New Testament than any other Old Testament figure. I think that's true because Abraham is the Old Testament how to be saved man. When Paul wants an illustration of how a person was saved in the Old Testament, he went to Abraham and he went to David to prove that you weren't saved by good works. When Paul wants to reinforce in Galatians that justification and the Christian life and the whole Christian experience is not based on good works, but on faith and on trusting God day by day, moment by moment, whether in phase one or phase two, he goes to Abraham to prove it. See? He says, we are the spiritual seed of Abraham because we are in the faith line, see? Faith lineage. Abraham is important for many reasons. He is the progenitor of course, the Jewish nation, but he is also the how-to-be-saved man of the Old Testament. He is mentioned more times than anybody else in the Old Testament, in the New Testament. Okay? Okay. Well, the lead in the latter part of chapter 11 is leading into chapter 12. So let's go down to verse 31 of chapter 11. And Terah took Abraham, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abraham's wife, and they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. Now you might write yourself a little note there. They knew the direction they were to go, but they didn't know the specifics. That is, they didn't know the exact stopping place. They didn't know the specific location where they were to stop. Let me draw in a little map here which represents the coastline of Palestine. This promontory here is Mount Carmel. This is Asia Minor. And over here in Armenia, the Tigris, the Euphrates and the Tigris rise and flow for a couple thousand miles before they join down near Babylon. Well, this is where Ur of the Chaldees was. Haran was up here on the Fertile Crescent. That's probably 600 miles at least. And you couldn't go across here because this is the Arabian Desert. Now, they very well knew that Canaan was over here. They knew where Canaan was. They knew how to get to Canaan. They knew they didn't have a jet to hop on and fly over the Arabian Desert. And you couldn't get through the Suez Canal, for obvious reasons, historically. If you're a little bit chronologically oriented, you'd understand that. They had to go around Fertile Crescent, which was quite a trip. Well, when they got up in Haran, they got stalled. But they were going in this direction. The idea is they knew where they were going in terms of general direction, but not the specific place. And I'll show that to you in the book of Hebrews in a little while. Okay? And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Now the Lord had said, it says in the King James, unto Abraham. Now, in Hebrew, there is no expression "had said" at all in the Hebrew text. There is simply just the expression, "Now the Lord said unto Abraham, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, into a land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless you, curse him that curses you, and in you shall all the nations of the earth be blessed." So Abraham departed as the Lord had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him. And Abraham was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. And Abraham took Sarah his wife, and Lot his brother's son, and all their substance that they had gathered, and the souls they had gotten in Haran. And they went forth to go into the land of Canaan, and into the land of Canaan they came. And Abraham passed through the land unto the place of Sichem, or Shechem, unto the plain of Moreh, and the Canaanite was then in the land. And the Lord appeared unto Abraham and said, "Unto thy seed will I give this land." See, it's after he gets there that God says, "This is the place." And there he builded an altar unto the Lord who appeared unto him, and he removed from thence unto a mountain on the east of Bethel, and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west, and Ai on the east, and there he builded an altar unto the Lord, and called upon the name of the Lord. And Abraham journeyed, going still toward the south. Now, in that context, you cannot tell whether God made the initial Abrahamic covenant to Abraham after he got in Haran or before he got to Haran. In other words, there's an important chronological sequence of the unfolding of the Abrahamic covenant, and the initial giving of the covenant, a question is raised as to whether it was given to Abraham in Ur or whether it was given at Haran, which was about 600-700 miles from Ur. Moreover, in the initial giving of the Abrahamic covenant, sort of a basic unfolding of God's dealing with man is revealed. And it is this: God gives the promise on the basis often of a condition. Sometimes a promise will not have a condition, sometimes it will. Regardless, if you want the blessing of the promise, you buy the promise by faith. In other words, promise, faith response equals blessing. God gives a promise, buy the promise by faith equals blessing. If you want the blessing, you've got to believe the promise and apply it, whether there's a condition in the promise or not. Now, in the initial giving of the Abrahamic covenant, there was a condition. And the condition was imperative mode. Get out of your country and from your kindred into a place that I will show you. Then I will bless you and make of you a great nation. God gives the promise. Homo sapien buys the promise, gets the blessing. Doesn't buy the promise, doesn't get the blessing. Now, this happens from the beginning of the Bible all the way to the end. And Abraham becomes illustrative of that. Same principle holds true today. God gives the promise. Buy the promise by faith. Believe it. Apply it to your life. You get the blessing. Don't buy the promise. Don't apply it to your life. Don't get the blessing. When I talk about applying a promise to our life, I'm talking really about believing it. We act upon what we believe. If we say we believe a promise and we don't act upon it, that means we really don't believe it. We really don't grasp it and take it into our frame of reference and believe it. We don't trust it, see. So, Abraham is going to buy this promise. Now, it's important that we delineate this whole procedure. That is, the chronology of the unfolding of the Abrahamic covenant.
and the specifics of the Abrahamic covenant, and then the results of it. So what I want to do is to give you some notes on the Abrahamic covenant. Abrahamic covenant, which becomes the basic agreement between God and Abraham. Maybe we should say something about a covenant first, okay? Let's just, without points, I'm interested in the Abrahamic covenant, but you need to know something about covenant, right? We've expressed some of this before. Covenant in the Old Testament is always the word berith. Berith. Okay? Berith. Now, berith means a cutting. And that in turn comes to mean a contract. A contract. An agreement. A covenant. Okay, or a compact. Okay. Now, in the Old Testament, this word covenant will be used with man to man, that is, individual to individual. The word will be used with nation to nation, that is, Israel will make a covenant with other nations. And the word berith will be used. It is used of an individual to a group. You make a contract. You make a legal document that spells out what the responsibilities of both parties are. Okay? Now, the important one that we're interested in here is a contract between God and man. These are the critical covenants of the Bible. Most people look at the statement, the New Testament, and they don't understand that the word testament really means covenant. It means the new covenant. And the New Testament unfolds all the glories and the blessings, spiritual, physical, every other way, of the new covenant. So a covenant is an agreement and a contract. And the Abrahamic covenant is one of the first great, momentous, spelled out covenants of the Old Testament. We've already had one. What was that? What covenant have we had up to this point where the word is first used? The Noahic covenant. The word is first used in the 9th chapter of Genesis with Noah. And all that covenant was an agreement of God with man that he would not destroy the world by a flood again. Okay? But the Abrahamic covenant is going to be much more detailed, much more spelled out. Okay? Okay, so when God makes a covenant, it means this. When God makes a covenant, it is a compact by God with man, whereby God obligates himself, whereby God obligates himself to bring to pass what he covenants. What he covenants. Okay? Some covenants are conditional. Some are not. All right, let's have a little review very quickly in our mentalities. Let's think a little bit. What are the five major covenants of the Old Testament that are mentioned in the Old Testament, the major ones? We have number one, the Abrahamic. What's the second? Palestinian. That's out of order. That's the third. What's the second? Levitical covenant. Okay? The third one is the Palestinian. What's the fourth? The Davidic covenant. What's the fifth? The new covenant. Okay? Okay. Now, the Abrahamic covenant in the initial giving of the covenant was conditional, wasn't it? What was the condition of the initial giving of the Abrahamic covenant? Get out of the land. There was no indication in the initial giving of the covenant that if Abraham did not remove himself from the land, that he would be blessed. But after he removes himself from the land and gets down in Canaan, then God says, Abraham, God did speak Hebrew, you know. Abraham, this is the place. Did he put any condition on it? No way. None at all. So in the initial giving, it was just, get out. I'll show you. Then he says, this is the place. The second covenant was the Levitical covenant. The Levitical covenant is the whole ceremonial religious spectrum of Israel after leaving Sinai, how they were to approach God after they left Sinai. There were certain provisions in the Levitical economy that were definitely conditional. The Palestinian covenant, in which he, after they get ready to move into the land, which is given in Deuteronomy, is conditional on their obedience. If they aren't obedient, God's going to take the land away from them. The Davidic covenant was not conditional at all. The Davidic covenant, David says, David spoke Hebrew too. God, I'm thankful. It's hard to imagine David speaking Hebrew. I'm thankful for all the blessing you give me. I'm going to build a house for you. I'm raising the money right now. And God looked over the parapets of heaven and said, no, David, you're not going to build a house for me, and I really love you. I'll tell you what, I'm going to build a house for you. I'm going to build a house into perpetuity so that your lineage will rule into perpetuity. Thanks, David. Tell you what, David, thanks for getting the stuff, but I'll let your son build the house that you're talking about, but I'm going to build you a house. Your son is going to sit on the throne of David into perpetuity. And that, of course, was a reference to Christ. No condition. The new covenant in the Old Testament, which is mentioned in Jeremiah 31 through 33, speaks of God bringing great blessing, spiritual blessing on Israel. It's mainly spiritual blessing. And, of course, it is going to produce the obedience in Israel that is necessary for the fulfilling of the Palestinian covenant so that they will have the land in the end. So what we're saying is that a covenant is a contract, and there are five very important ones in the Old Testament between God and man in which God dictates terms of the covenant. When he does that, he guarantees his part in the matter. Okay? Okay, let's move on to the Abrahamic covenant. Number one, the initiation, confirmation, and this is maybe all we'll get done tonight, I'm not sure, but if we do, that's a good chunk. And enlargement of the Abrahamic covenant. Oh, It's important for you to know, if you're a student of the Bible or you're interested in becoming a student of the Bible, that the Abrahamic covenant will be mentioned again and again and again and again, not only in the Old Testament, but also in the New Testament. It'll be mentioned throughout Scripture. Okay? All right. The initiation, confirmation, and enlargement of the Abrahamic covenant. Point A. God spoke to Abraham, and we'll call him Abram, because his name has not been changed yet, while he was living in Ur, in the home of Terah, and idolater. Joshua 24:2, Acts 7:2-3, Nehemiah 9:7. Will you turn, please, to Joshua 24:2? Joshua 24:2. You'll get a little hint here of how the Old Testament will repeat and repeat and repeat relative to this covenant. The setting of Joshua 24:2 is the point in Israelite history when Joshua was about to die. We are near 1386 B.C. 1386 B.C. We are 600 years removed from the death of Abraham. And the children of Israel have come out of Egypt. They have conquered the land. They have divided the land among the 12 tribes. And Joshua is ready to kick the bucket. So like all good Old Testament leaders, he gathers all the people together and he's going to preach to them right before he dies. Verse 1, Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem, same place Abraham had journeyed to that we read in the 13th, 12th chapter of Genesis. Called for the elders of Israel, for their heads, for their judges, for all the officers, and they presented themselves before God. And Joshua said unto all the people, thus saith Jehovah Elohim of Israel, your fathers dwelt on the other side of not the flood, as the King James says. The word is really Nahar. Nahar. Or Nahar. And that means river. What river? Euphrates, of course. Your fathers dwelt on the other side of the river in old time, even Terah, the father of Abraham, the father of Nahor, and they served other gods. Now that meant that an apostasy had set in the Shemite lineage that included Terah and perhaps a few more of Abraham's immediate predecessors. We don't know how many. But the picture is one of general apostasy. Now listen to me for a minute. That is the picture of the entire biblical scene. I don't care what age you live in. Adam and Eve sinned. Adam and Eve were created, not perfect, but innocent. They sinned. A judgment came. You move then from Adam to Noah. You are moving through time and through generations. The earth is being populated, etc., etc., etc. But it's degenerating. And so God intervenes with a judgment. You pick up after that judgment, you begin again with Noah and his three sons, and you move on in time, and you come to Babel. And men are flaunting themselves in the face of God. They are doing exactly opposite what they were told to do by God. He told them to scatter and fill up the earth. Instead, they gather together and they build a tower at Babel, in the faith of God, and God judged them again and scattered them through the judgment. Now that is what has happened up to the point where you come to Abraham. You start in the Shemite line, and every, you know, you start in that Shemite line where the knowledge of the of God is going to be preserved, and you get an apostasy by the time you get to Abraham. So what happens? God starts all over again with Abraham, one man's family. And he's going to deal with the world through one man's family. And you move through time from 21, well, from about 2000, 2166 minus 75, 2096, Abraham's 75 when he moves into Canaan. You move from 2000, what did I say? 096. You move down in Israel's history, and by the time David dies, the nation is in abject apostasy. And they're not going to recover from it. 930 BC, Solomon takes over the throne. No, 970 he takes over the throne. He dies in 930, and the kingdom is divided. Never gets back together. You have absolute, almost abject apostasy. Just a few revivals on the way, and then they're going to be taken over by Babylonia. Well, the northern kingdom will fall in 721 to Assyria. The southern kingdom will fall in 606 to Babylon, and there will be no Israelitish state until 1948 AD. God judged Israel. Every age has ended in the failure of man and in a judgment. The church age will end in a sense, in the failure of the church. I don't like to say it that way, but it kind of looks that way. And certainly, if you look at the Great Tribulation period as an introduction, as a consummation of one age and an introduction to another, that's a judgment. Yeah. In other words, just the opposite of the evolutionary schemata. It's a picture, the biblical picture is one of degeneration of man. Faithfulness of God, degeneration of man. Here we have an apostasy. Now, the important thing about the verse is that in verse 3 we're told, "And I took your father Abraham from the other side of the flood and led him through, or other side of the river, all the land of Canaan and multiplied its seed and gave him Isaac." Hey, will you note the Hebrew philosophy of history? Watch this. Underline the verbs in the subject, verse 3. "I took your father Abraham. I led him throughout the land of Canaan. I multiplied his seed. I gave him Isaac." Verse 4. "I gave unto Isaac Jacob and Esau. I gave unto Esau Mount Seir." Look at verse 5. "I sent Moses also and Aaron. I plagued Egypt." Verse 6. "I brought your fathers out of Egypt." Well, you want to write yourself a little note in the margin. You might put the Hebrew philosophy of history is included here. Joshua 24, Psalm 105, Acts chapter 7. And Nehemiah chapter 9. The Hebrew philosophy of history arises out of the concept of the Abrahamic covenant, that God had chosen Abraham and sent him on a mission to a place and then gave him a people and a nation. And out of that concept comes the Hebrew philosophy of history. That's kind of a big deal with me. When I was in the graduate department at the University of Colorado, all graduate history students have to take HI 501-502, which is the history of history, or the history of historians, or the history of writing history. And we had a man in the honors department that was a scholar in ancient Rome and ancient Greece. Wasn't exactly in the history department. And he and I didn't get along. We just didn't get along because he knew that I was a Christian and he just hated Christians. I mean, just for no reason at all. I went to him one time and I says, "I want to take a comprehensive in Greek." And he says, "Okay." I says, fine, here's a Greek New Testament. Pick out any passage, and I'll read it to you. And I'll locate any word you want to locate it by sight. I'll tell you whether it's a noun, an adjective. I'll tell you a case, number, gender. I'll tell you the use in the sentence. Pick out any verb, any number you want. Oh, no, I won't let you take it in the Greek New Testament. I says, why not? He says, it's too easy. I says, you got to be kidding. You got clucks in this school that take a crash course in French. Graduate students that take crash courses in French, and when they get done, they don't know a noun from a verb or an adjective or a participle. And because they pass the course, they get it accredited to them that they have a modern language. And they don't know beans about the language. And German the same way. So he and I, we didn't hit it off. And he got up and he lectured on the history of historians. And he said, now the great father of all historians is Herodotus. He is the high priest of historians. And Thucydides, the Greeks were the first to have a philosophy of history. So I cornered him after class and I said, you made a major boo-boo this morning. You made a very, very major boo-boo this morning. Joshua lived 800 years before Herodotus was ever on the scene, and 900 before Thucydides. And Joshua writes a philosophy of Hebrew history in the 24th chapter that is just fantastic. You've got to read it sometime. What was a Hebrew philosophy of history? We have a personal, loving, moral, ethical, righteous God who chose us to be His own. And He did this, and He did that. Doesn't mean that Abraham didn't make decisions. Doesn't mean that Moses didn't make decisions. They all made decisions, but when you look at the whole picture, it is God did this, and God did that, and God did this, and God led us into Egypt, and God led us out of Egypt, and God led us into the land, and God gave us the land, and so on. That's the Hebrew philosophy of history, which, of course, has been lost since the Babylonian captivity, 606 B.C. Well, it goes back to that Abrahamic covenant, see? And every time there is a revival in the Old Testament time, there is a return to the covenants. The Abrahamic covenant, the Sinaitic covenant, the Palestinian covenant. They return to these fundamentals and they reemphasize them. Okay? Okay, we're trying to emphasize that the fact that it was while Abraham was in Ur of the Chaldees that this happened, and the 7th chapter of Acts reaffirms it. In fact, 7th chapter of Acts states it emphatically. This is Stephen addressing the Sanhedrin. He is about to become not the first martyr of the church, because Paul had already killed many believers before Stephen. Well, is that true? No, that's not true, is it? I guess that's not true. No, Paul, we don't read of Paul killing any Christians until after Stephen gets killed. So maybe Stephen could be considered one of the first. Before he dwelt in Haran, and he said unto him, get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred, and come into the land which I will show you. And he came out of the land of the Chaldeans and dwelt in Haran, and from thence, when his father died or was dead, he removed him into this land wherein you now dwell. Okay? Okay. Point B. That's enough. The important word here is, of course, before he dwelt in Haran. Point B. God commanded Abram to leave Ur. And go in the direction of Canaan. but without specifics. Without specifics. Now this we know by Hebrews 11:8. Will you turn there? Hebrews 11:8. This is one of the most exciting incidents, I feel, in the Bible. This story of Abraham leaving Ur. And I want to try to communicate that to you before we leave tonight. And the Bible implements this, see, with these little additional revelatory statements. You piece the picture together. Hebrews 11:8, the great faith chapter. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, he obeyed. And he went out, not knowing whithersoever he went. Now what does that mean? Does that mean he went out and he walked around in circles? And he kept making a bigger circle? And saying, Lord, stop me when I get to the right spot. No, it says he went with Terah to go into the land of Canaan in Genesis chapter 11 and verse 31. They knew the general place. But he did not know whither he went in terms of specifics. Not knowing where specifically. Now I'd like to show you that, I didn't spell that right. I'd like to show you this little verbal, not knowing, okay? This little verbal is a participle with a me negating particle in front of it. Me epistamenos. Me epistamenos. M-E-E-P-I-S-T-A-M-E-N-O-S. Translated, not knowing in the New Testament. Now this is epistamai, or this the source of this is epistamai. And epistamai, epi means upon. Upon. Epistamai is a form of histami, which means to set or to fix. To set or to fix. To set or to fix upon. Now, if you're set or fixed upon something, the implication of that is that you know what that something is. You know about it, see? Hence, this comes to mean, hence, to understand. To understand. To be versed in. Abraham went out of Ur of the Chaldees to a place that he wasn't versed in. He didn't know where specifically he was going. He only knew the general direction. But he was acting, listen to me now, he was acting upon this principle. God said it. God commanded it. God promised blessing if I did it. I'm going to trust God for the blessing. And he went. And he got the blessing. Maximal blessing of God presupposes right thinking. Right thinking is based upon facts. Right thinking relative to God includes obedience to what God commands. To say that we believe God and we're disobedient to him is to tell a lie. Okay? Okay. Now, God commanded Abraham to leave Ur of the Chaldees. And so in the initial blessing, or in the initial covenant, point C, there was a condition. In the initial giving of the covenant, there was one condition. Leave your moorings in Ur. Family moorings, all kind of ties in Ur.
Okay. Point D. In partial obedience, Abram goes to Haran with his family. Genesis 11:31. But receives none of the blessing there. No fulfillment of promises is the idea. Okay? No fulfillment of promises. Now, we do not know how long he was in Ur of the Chaldees. We do not know how old he was when God gave him the initial challenge. We're not told. But we do know that when he went down into Palestine and was told by God this is the place, that he was 75. So, point E, and the final point under the initial confirmation and enlargement of the Abrahamic covenant. Point E, thus after partial obedience, Abram journeys to Canaan and God institutes an irrevocable and unconditional and ageless. The word that we used is eternal. An ageless covenant. Now all it is an expansion on the original covenant. So that while he is in Canaan, maybe I should call this expanded covenant. Okay? So that while he is in Canaan, you will read of the expansion of that covenant. In 12, 6 and 7. In 13 of Genesis, chapter 14 through 17. In 15, verses 1 through 21, Abie's getting old. He only has a steward of his house. He says, he just come back from meeting with Melchizedek, and God says, "Ah, bless you, Abraham. Oh, Abraham, I love you for what you did there with Melchizedek." And Abraham says, "What are you talking about? I don't even have a child yet. I got this steward of the house, Eliezer. He's going to inherit everything." God says, "Go outside, Abraham. Look up at the stars. Abraham, I'm going to bless you. I'm going to bless you. Your seed will be like the stars. It'll be like the sand. You won't be able to count it." And he puts Abraham in a deep sleep. And Abraham sees an offering split in half, and he sees the Shekinah glory pass between the parts of that split offering. And God is saying, "Abraham, I'll become like this split sacrifice if I don't fulfill my promise to you." So Abraham begins to scheme, and Sarah, he's getting older, he's 89, Sarah says, "What are we going to do? We don't have any kids yet. Abraham, I'm getting pretty old, you know." She says, "Take Hagar, have a child." Abraham has a child. God says, "Sorry, Abraham, that's the wrong one. I'm going to tell you more about the covenant." Then finally, after the miracle child is born, he reaffirms the covenant again. See, every one of those passages, all through his life, God is saying, "This is the covenant, this is the covenant, this is the covenant I make. No, it's not Ishmael. No, it's not anybody else. It'll be the miracle child, Isaac." An exciting story. One of the things that makes it more exciting for me is to know what Abraham left behind in Ur.
And so next week, I chased too many rabbits tonight. I want to tell you about Ur of the Chaldees that Abraham lived in. He lived in a house that was bigger than mine. Now, wait a minute. My house isn't real big. I live in Sainsville, but I have a nice house. I like it. A.B. had a bigger house than I did. Guarantee you that in Ur. I'll show you that next week. Along with the details of the Abrahamic covenant. Any questions we could try to answer before we go? Okay, shall we close in prayer? We thank you, our Father, that your word continually reminds us not only that you are infinite, but that you are very personal, very concerned with every member of the human race, with each of us in this room. And believers have become the apple of your eye, those who respond to grace through faith. Now help us that we won't undersell you. We won't underestimate you. May our faith be characterized by action, not by words, but by what we do, like Abraham. And we pray that you'll shake us in this place where we seem to be so lethargic, so dull, so insensitive, that it might be manifest that we do action with the personal, infinite God through your Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, our Savior. We pray in his name. Amen.